The Wild Palms. On the second morning in the Chicago hotel, Wilburn waked and found that Charlotte was dressed and gone, hat, coat, and handbag, leaving a note for him in a big, sprawling, untrained hand, such as you associate at first glance with a man, until you realize an instant later it is profoundly feminine. Back at noon, C. Then, beneath the initial, or maybe later. She returned before noon. He was asleep again. She sat on the side of the bed, her hand in his hair, rolling his head on the pillow to shake him awake, still in the open coat and the hat shoved back from her forehead, looking down at him with that sober yellow profundity. And now he mused indeed on that efficiency of women in the mechanics, the domiciling of cohabitation. Not thrift, not husbandry, something far beyond that. Who, the entire race of them, employed with infallible instinct, a completely uncerebrated rapport for the type and nature of male partner and situation, either the cold penuriousness of the fabled Vermont farm wife, or the fantastic extravagance of the Broadway Review mistress, as required, absolutely without regard for the intrinsic value of the medium which they saved or squandered, and with little more regard or grief for the bauble which they bought or lacked, using both the presence and absence of jewel or checking account as pawns in a chess game whose prize was not security at all, but respectability within the milieu in which they lived, even the love nest under the rose to follow a rule and a pattern. He thought, it's not the romance of illicit love which draws them, not the passionate idea of two damned and doomed and isolated forever against the world and God and the irrevocable which draws men. It's because the idea of illicit love is a challenge to them, because they have an irresistible desire to, and an unshakable belief that they can, as they all believe they can successfully conduct a boarding house, take the illicit love and make it respectable. Take Lothario himself and trim the very incorrigible bachelor's ringlets which snared them into the seemly decorum of Monday's hash and suburban trains.
I found it, she said.
Found what?
An apartment, a studio, where I can work too.
Too? She shook his head again with that savage obliviousness. She actually hurt him a little. He thought again, there's a part of her that doesn't love anybody, anything. And then a profound and silent lightning clap, a white glare, ratiocination, instinct, he did not know which. Why, she's alone. Not lonely, alone. She had a father, and then four brothers exactly like him, and then she married a man exactly like the four brothers, and so she probably never even had a room of her own in all her life. And so she has lived all her life in complete solitude, and she doesn't even know it, as a child who has never tasted cake doesn't know what cake is.
Yes, two. Do you think that $1,200 will last forever? You live in sin. You can't live on it.
I know it. I thought of that before I told you over the phone that night I had $1,200. But this is honeymoon. Later will be.
I know that, too.
She grasped his hair again, hurting him again, though now he knew she was hurting him.
Listen, it's got to be all honeymoon, always, forever and ever, until one of us dies. It can't be anything else. Either heaven or hell. No comfortable, safe, peaceful purgatory between for you and me to wait in until good behavior or forbearance or shame or repentance overtakes us.
So it's not me you believe in, put trust in. It's love. She looked at him. Not just me, any man.
Yes, it's love. They say love dies between two people. That's wrong. It doesn't die. It just leaves you, goes away, if you are not good enough, worthy enough. It doesn't die. you're the one that dies. It's like the ocean. If you're no good, if you begin to make a bad smell in it, it just spews you up somewhere to die.
You die anyway, but I had rather drown in the ocean than be irped up onto a strip of dead beach and be dried away by the sun into a little foul smear with no name to it. Just, "This was," for an epitaph.
Get up. I told the man we would move in today.
They left the hotel with their bags within the hour, by cab. They mounted 3 flights of stairs. She even had the key. She opened the door for him to enter. He knew she was not looking at the room, but at him.
"Well," she said, "do you like it?"
It was a big oblong room with a skylight in the north wall, possibly the handiwork of a dead or bankrupt photographer, or maybe a former sculptor or painter tenant, with 2 cubbyholes for kitchen and bath. She rented that skylight, he told himself quietly, thinking how, as a rule, women rent bathrooms primarily. It's only incidental that there is a place to sleep and cook food. She chose a place not to hold us, but to hold love. She did not just run from one man to another. She did not merely mean to swap one piece of clay she made a bust with for another. He moved now, and then he thought, "Maybe I'm not embracing her, but clinging to her, because there is something in me that won't admit it can't swim or can't believe it can." "It's all right," he said. "It's fine. Nothing can beat us now." During the next 6 days, he made the rounds of the hospitals, interviewing, or being interviewed by, residents and staff heads. They were brief interviews. He was not particular what he did, and he had something to offer: his degree from a good medical school, his 20 months' internship in a hospital which was known. Yet always after the first 3 or 4 minutes, something began to happen. He knew what it was, though he told himself differently. This sitting after the 5th interview on a sunny bench in a park among the bums and WPA gardeners and nursemaids and children. "It's because I really don't try hard enough. Don't really realize the need for trying, because I have accepted completely her ideas about love. I look upon love with the same boundless faith that it will clothe and feed me as the Mississippi or Louisiana countryman, converted last week at a camp meeting revival, looks upon religion. Knowing that that was not the reason, that it was the 20 months of internship instead of 24. Thinking, I have been confounded by numbers. Thinking how it is apparently more seemly to die in the dulcet smell than to be saved by an apostate from convention. At last he found a job. It was not much. It was laboratory work in a charity hospital in the Negro tenement district, where victims of alcohol or pistol and knife wounds were brought, usually by police, and his job was making routine tests for syphilis. "You don't need a microscope or Wasserman paper," he told her that night. "All you need is enough light to tell what race they belong to." She had set 2 planks on trestles beneath the skylight, which she called her workbench, and at which for some time now she had been puttering with a package of plaster of Paris from the 10-cent store, though he had paid little attention to what she was doing. She now bent over this table with a scrap of paper and a pencil, while he watched the blunt, supple hand make the big, sprawling, rapid figures. "You will make this much a month," she said, "and it costs this much for us to live a month, and we have this much to draw from to make up the difference." The figures were cold, incontrovertible. The very pencil marks had a scornful and impregnable look. Incidentally, she now saw to it that he made not only the current weekly remittances to his sister, but that he had also sent to her the equivalent sum of the lunches and the abortive hotel during the 6 weeks in New Orleans. Then she wrote down a date beside the last figure. It would be in early September. "On that day, we won't have any money left." Then he repeated something he had thought while sitting on the park bench that day. "It will be all right. I've just got to get used to love. I never tried it before, you see.
I'm at least 10 years behind myself. I'm still freewheeling, but I'll get back into gear soon.
Yes, she said. Then she crumpled the paper and flipped it aside, turning.
But that's not important. That's just whether it's steak or hamburger. And hunger's not here.
She struck his belly with the flat of her hand.
That's just your old guts growling. Hunger's here.
She touched his breast.
Don't you ever forget that.
I won't. Not now.
But you may.
You've been hungry down here in your guts, so you are afraid of it. Because you are always a little afraid of what you have stood. If you had ever been in love before, you wouldn't have been on that train that afternoon, would you?
Yes, he said. Yes. Yes.
So it's more than just training your brain to remember hunger's not in the belly. Your belly, your guts themselves, have got to believe it.
Can yours believe it?
Yes, he said. Only she's not so sure of that, he told himself. Because 3 days later, when he returned from the hospital, he found the workbench littered with twisted bits of wire and bottles of shellac and glue and wood fiber, a few tubes of paint and a pan in which a mass of tissue paper soaked in water, which 2 afternoons later had become a collection of little figures, deer and wolfhounds and horses and men and women, lean, epicene, sophisticated and bizarre, with a quality fantastic and perverse. The afternoon after that, when he returned, she and the figures were gone. She came in an hour later, her yellow eyes like a cat's in the dark, not triumph or exultation, but rather fierce affirmation, and with a new $10 bill.
He took them all, she said. She named a leading department store.
Then he let me dress one of the windows. I have an order for $100 more. Historical figures about Chicago, this part of the West. You know, Mrs. O'Leary with Nero's face and the cow with a ukulele. Kit Carson with legs like Nijinsky and no face, just 2 eyes and a shelf of forehead to shade them with. Buffalo cows with the heads and flanks of Arabian mares. And all the other stores on Michigan Avenue. Here, take it.
He refused. It's yours. You earned it.
She looked at him, the unwinking yellow stare in which he seemed to blunder and fumble like a moth, a rabbit caught in the glare of a torch, an envelopment almost like a liquid, a chemical precipitant in which all the dross of small lying and sentimentality dissolved away.
You don't like the idea of your woman helping to support you, is that it?
Listen, don't you like what we've got?
You know I do.
Then what does it matter what it cost us, what we pay for it, or how?
You stole the money we've got now. Wouldn't you do it again?
Isn't it worth it, even if it all busts tomorrow and we have to spend the rest of our lives paying interest?
Yes, only it's not going to bust tomorrow, nor next month, nor next year.
No, not as long as we are worthy of keeping it. Good enough, strong enough. Worthy to be allowed to keep it. To get what you want as decently as you can, then keep it. Keep it.
She came and put her arms around him, hard, striking her body against him, hard. Not in caress, but exactly as she would grasp him by the hair to wake him up from sleep.
That's what I'm going to do. Try to do. I like bitching and making things with my hands. I don't think that's too much to be permitted to like. To want, to have, and keep.
She earned that $100, working at night now, after he was in bed and sometimes asleep. During the next 5 weeks she earned $28 more. Then she filled an order amounting to 50. Then the orders stopped. She could get no more. Nevertheless, she continued to work, at night altogether now, since she was out with her samples, her completed figures all day, and she worked usually with an audience now, for now their apartment had become a sort of evening club. It began with a newspaper man named McCord, who had worked on a New Orleans paper during the brief time when Charlotte's youngest brother, in a dilettante and undergraduate healer manner, Wilburn gathered, had cubbed there. She met him on the street. He came to dinner one evening and took them out to dinner one evening. 3 nights later, he appeared with 3 men and 2 women and 4 bottles of whiskey at their apartment. And after that, Wilburn never knew just whom he would find when he reached home, except that it would not be Charlotte alone, and, regardless of who was there, Idle, who, even after the dearth season of sales had extended into weeks and then a month, and summer was almost upon them, still worked in a cheap coverall already filthy as that of any house painter, and a glass of whiskey and water among the twists of wire and pots of glue and paint and plaster, which transformed steadily and endlessly beneath the deft, untiring hands into the effigies, elegant, bizarre, fantastic, and perverse. Then she made a final sale, a small one, and it was done, finished. It stopped as abruptly and inexplicably as it had begun. The summer season was on now, they told her at the stores, and the tourists and natives, too, were leaving town to escape the heat. "Except that that's a lie," she said. "It's the saturation point," she told him, told them all. It was at night. She had returned late with the cardboard box containing the figures which had been refused, so the evening's collection of callers had already arrived. "But I expected it, because these are just fun." She had taken the effigies from the box and set them up on the workbench again. "Like something created to live only in the pitch airless dark. Like in a bank vault, or maybe a poison swamp. Not in the rich, normal, nourishing air breathed off of guts full of vegetable from Oak Park and Evanston. And so that's it, and that's all. And now I'm not an artist anymore, and I'm tired and I'm hungry, and I'm going to curl up with one of our good books and one of our crusts. So let each and all of you step up to the bench and choose himself or herself one souvenir and memento of this occasion, and beat it." "We can still beat a crust," he told her. "And besides, she's not done yet," he thought. "She hasn't quit yet. She never will," thinking, as he had thought before, that there was a part of her which he, nor Rittenmeyer either, had ever touched, which did not even love love. In less than a month he believed that he had proof of this. He returned and found her at the bench again, in a profound excitement which he had never seen before, an excitement without exultation, but with a grim and deadly quality of irresistible driving, as she told him about it. It was one of the men whom McCord had brought, a photographer. She was to make puppets, marionettes, and he to photograph them for magazine covers and advertisements. Perhaps later they would use the actual puppets in charades, tableau, a hired hall, a rented stable, something, anything. "It's my money," she told him, "the $125 I never could get you to take." She worked with dense and concentrated fury. She would be at the bench when he went to sleep. He would wake at 2 and 3 o'clock and find the fierce working light above it still burning. Now he would return, from the hospital at first, then from the park bench where he spent his days after he lost his job, leaving and returning home at the usual hours so she would not suspect, and see the actual figures almost as large as small children. A Quixote with a gaunt, mad, dreamy, uncoordinated face. A Falstaff with the worn face of a syphilitic barber and gross with meat. A single figure, yet when he looked at it he seemed to see 2, the man and the gross flesh like a huge bear and its fragile, consumptive keeper. It seemed to him that he could actually watch the man struggling with the mountain of entrails as the keeper might wrestle with the bear, not to overcome it, but to pass it, escape it, as you do with the atavistic beasts in nightmare. Roxanne, with spit curls and a wad of gum like the sheet music demonstrator in a 10-cent store. Cyrano, with the face of a low comedy Jew in vaudeville, the monstrous flare of whose nostrils ceased exactly on the instant of becoming mollusks, a piece of cheese in one hand and a checkbook in the other, accumulating about the apartment, filling all available spaces of floor and walls, fragile, perverse, and disturbing, with incredible rapidity. Begun, continued, and completed in one sustained rush of furious industry. A space of time broken not into successive days and nights, but a single interval interrupted only by eating and sleeping. Then she finished the last one, and now she would be gone all day and half the night. He would return in the afternoon and find a scrawled note on a scrap of paper or a margin torn from a newspaper or even the telephone book. "Don't wait for me. Go out and eat," which he would do and return and go to bed and sometimes to sleep until she slid naked. She never wore a sleeping garment. She told him she had never owned one. Into bed to wake him, rouse him to listen with a hard wrestling movement, holding him in her hard arms while she talked in a grim, quiet, rapid voice, not about money or its lack, not about the details of the day's progress with the photographing, but of their present life and situation, as though it were a complete whole without past or future, in which they themselves as individuals, the need for money, the figures she had made, were component parts like the parts of a tableau or a puzzle, none more important than another. Lying still and relaxed in the darkness while she held him, not even bothering to be aware whether his eyes were open or not, he seemed to see their joint life as a fragile globe, a bubble which she kept balanced and intact above disaster like a trained seal does its ball. "She's worse off than I am," he thought. "She doesn't even know what it is to hope." Then the puppet business ended, as abruptly and completely as the window dressing had. He returned one evening, and she was at home reading. The filthy overall in which she had lived for weeks—it was August now—was gone, and then he saw that the workbench was not only clean of its former litter of wire and paint, it had been drawn into the center of the room and had become a table covered with a strip of chintz and stacked with the magazines and books which formerly had rested upon the floor and in the unused chairs and such, and, most surprising of all, a bowl of flowers. "I've got some things here," she said. "We'll eat at home for a change." She had chops and such. She prepared the meal in a curiously frivolous apron, new, too, like the chintz on the table. He thought how failure, reacting upon her like on a man, by investing her with a sort of dignified humility, had yet brought out in her a quality which he had never seen before, a quality not only female, but profoundly feminine. They ate, then she cleared the table. He offered to help, but she refused. So he sat with a book beside the lamp. He heard her in the kitchen for a time. Then she emerged and entered the bedroom. He did not hear her when she came out of the bedroom at all, since her bare feet made no sound on the floor. He just looked up to see her standing beside him, the compactly simple rightness of the body lines, the sober, intent, yellow stare. She took the book from him and put it on the converted table. "Get your clothes off," she said. "The hell with it. I can still bitch." But he did not tell her about the job for another 2 weeks. His reason was no longer concern that the news might destroy her accord with what she was concentrating on, since that was no longer valid now, if it had ever been, and it was no longer the possibility that he might find something else before she would need to know, for that was not valid either now, since he had tried that and failed. Nor was it the Micawber-like faith of the inert in tomorrow. It was partly, perhaps, the knowledge that late enough would be soon enough. But mostly, he did not try to fool himself, it was a profound faith in her. Not in them, in her. "God won't let her starve," he thought. "She's too valuable. He did too well with her. Even the one who made everything must fancy some of it enough to want to keep it." So each day he would leave the apartment at the usual hour and sit on his bench in the park until time to go home. And once each day he would take out the wallet and produce the slip of paper on which he kept a record of the dwindling money, as if he expected each time to find that the amount had changed or that he had misread it the day before, finding each time that it had not, and he had not. The neat figures, the $182 less $5 or $10, with the date of each subtraction. By the day it would be due, there would be not enough to pay the quarter's rent on the first day of September. And then sometimes he would take out the other paper, the pink cashier's check with its perforated legend, only $300. There would be something almost ceremonial about it, like the formal preparation by the addict of his opium pipe. And then, for the time, he would as completely renounce reality as the opium smoker himself, while he invented 100 ways to spend it, shifting the various components of the sum and their bought equivalents here and there, like a jigsaw puzzle, knowing that this was a form of masturbation, thinking, because I am still and probably will always be in the puberty of money, that if it were really possible to cash the check and use the money, he would not even dare to toy with the idea. Then he returned home one afternoon and found her at the workbench again. It was still the table, still in the center of the room. She had merely turned back the chintz and shoved the books and magazines to one end, and she wore the apron and not the coverall, and she was working now with a kind of idle bemusement, like someone passing time with a deck of cards. The figure was not 3 inches tall, a little ancient, shapeless man with a foolish, disorganized face, the face of a harmless, imbecile clown. "It's a bad smell," she said. Then he understood. "That's all it is. Just a bad smell. Not a wolf at the door. Wolves are things, keen and ruthless. Strong, even if they are cowards. But this is just a bad smell, because hunger is not here." Again she struck his belly with the back of her hand. "Hunger's up there. It doesn't look like this. It looks like a skyrocket or a Roman candle, or at least one of those sparkler sticks for little children that sparkle away into a live red coal that's not afraid to die. But this," she looked up at him, then he knew it was coming. "How much money have we got?"
$148, but it's all right.
Oh, then you have paid next quarter's rent already." Then it came. It was too late now. "My trouble is, every time I tell either the truth or a lie, I seem to have to sell myself on the idea first."
"Look at me. You mean you haven't been to the hospital in 2 months?"
"It was the detective. You were busy then. That was the month you forgot to write to New Orleans. He wasn't trying to get me fired. He just hadn't heard from you, and he was worried. He was trying to find out if you were all right. It wasn't him, it was the detective who spilled the works. So they let me go. It was funny. I was fired from a job which existed because of moral turpitude, on the grounds of moral turpitude. Only it wasn't actually that, of course. The job just played out, as I knew in time it would."
"Well," she said, "and we haven't got a drink in the house. You go down to the store and get a bottle while I—" "No, wait. We'll go out and eat and drink both. Besides, we'll have to find a dog."
"A dog?" From where he stood, he could see her in the kitchen take from the icebox the 2 chops for supper and wrap them again.
"But certainly, friend," she said. "Get your hat."
It was evening, the hot August. The neon flashed and glared, alternately corpse and hell glowing the faces in the street, and their own, too, as they walked, she still carrying the 2 chops in the thick, slick, clammy butcher's paper. Within the block they met McCord.
"We've lost our job," she told him, "so we're looking for a dog."
Presently it began to seem to Wilburn that the invisible dog was actually among them. They were in a bar now, one which they frequented, meeting perhaps twice a week, by chance or prearrangement, the group which McCord had brought into their lives. There were 4 of these. "We've lost our job," McCord told them, and now we're waiting for a dog. Present now, the seven of them sitting about a table set for eight, an empty chair, an empty gap, the two chops unwrapped now and on a plate beside a glass of neat whiskey among the highballs. They had not eaten yet. Twice Wilburn leaned to her. "Hadn't we better eat something? It's all right. I can—" "Yes, it's all right. It's fine." She was not speaking to him. "We've got $48 too much. Just think of that. Even the armors haven't got $48 too much. Drink up, ye armorous sons. Keep up with the dog." "Yeah," McCord said. "Set, ye armorous sons, in a sea of Hemingways." The neon flashed and glared. The traffic lights blinked from green to red and back to green again above the squawking cabs and hearse-like limousines. They had not eaten yet, though they had lost two members of the party. They were six in the cab, sitting on each other's knees while Charlotte carried the chops. They had lost the paper now, and McCord held the invisible dog. It was named Moreover, now, from the Bible, the poor man's table. "But listen," McCord said, "just listen a minute. Doc and Gillespie and I own it. Gillespie's up there now, but he will have to be back in town by the first, and it will be empty. You could take your $100.
"You're impractical," Charlotte said. "You're talking about security. Have you no soul? How much money have we got now, Harry?"
He looked at the meter. $122. "But listen," McCord said.
"All right," she said. "But now is no time to talk. You've made your bed. Lie in it, and pull the covers over your head."
They were in Evanston now. They had stopped at a drugstore, and they had a flashlight now, the cab crawling along a suburban and opulent curb, while Charlotte, leaning across McCord, played the flashlight upon the passing midnight lawns.
"There's one," she said.
"I don't see it," McCord said.
"Look at that fence. Did you ever hear of an iron fence with a wreath of pansies in each panel that didn't have an iron dog inside of it? The house has got a mansard roof, too."
"I don't see any house," McCord said.
"I don't either, but look at that fence."
The cab stopped. They got out. The torch beam played on the iron fence with scrolled, spear-tipped panels set in concrete. There was even a hitching post in the effigy of a Negro boy beside the small, scrolled gate. "You're right," McCord said. "There'll be one here." They did not use the light now, but even in the faint starlight they could see it plainly. The cast-iron St. Bernard, with its composite face of the Emperor Franz Joseph and a Maine banker in the year 1859. Charlotte placed the chops upon the iron pediment, between the iron feet. They returned to the cab. "Listen," McCord said. "It's completely equipped. Three rooms and kitchen, bedding, cooking things, plenty of wood for the chopping. You can even bathe if you want to. And all the other cottages will be empty after the 1st of September, and nobody to bother you, and right on the lake. You can have fish for a while yet, and with your $100 in grub, and the cold won't come until in October, maybe not until November, you could stay up there until Christmas, or even longer than that if you don't mind the cold." McCord drove them up to the lake on the Saturday night before Labor Day. The $100 worth of food, the tins, the beans and rice and coffee and salt and sugar and flour, in the rumble. Wilburn contemplated the equivalent of their last dollar with a certain sobriety. "You don't realize how flexible money is until you exchange it for something," he said. "Maybe this is what the economists mean by a normal diminishing return." "You don't mean flexible," McCord said. "You mean volatile. That's what Congress means by a fluid currency. If it rains on us before we get this stuff under a roof, you'll see. Those beans and rice and truck will boil us clean out of the car like three matches in a pail of home brew." They had a bottle of whiskey, and McCord and Wilburn took turns driving while Charlotte slept. They reached the cottage just after dawn. 100-odd acres of water surrounded by second-growth spruce, four clearings with a cabin in each. From the chimney of one of them smoke stood.
"That's Bradley," McCord said. "I thought he'd be out by now."
And a short pier into the water.
There was a narrow finger of beach with a buck standing on it, pink in the Sunday dawn, its head up, watching them for an instant before it whirled, its white scut arcing in long bounds, while Charlotte, springing from the car, her face swollen with sleep, ran to the water's edge, squealing.
"That's what I was trying to make," she cried. "Not the animals, the dogs and deer and horses. The motion, the speed."
"Sure," McCord said. "Let's eat." They unloaded the car and carried the things in and started a fire in the stove. Then, while Charlotte cooked breakfast, Wilburn and McCord carried the bottle down to the water and squatted. They drank from the bottle, saluting one another. Then there was one drink left.
"Charlotte's," McCord said. "She can drink to the wagon, the long drouth."
"I'm happy now," Wilburn said. "I know exactly where I'm going. It's perfectly straight, between two rows of cans and sacks, $50 worth to a side. Not street, that's houses and people. This is a solitude."
Then the water, the solitude wavering slow while you lie and look up at it.
Squatting and still holding the almost empty bottle, he put his other hand into the water. The still, dawn-breathing liquid with the temperature of the synthetic ice water in hotel rooms, the ripples fanning slowly from his wrist. McCord stared at him.
"And then fall will come, the first cold, the first red and yellow leaves drifting down, the double leaves, the reflection rising to meet the falling one until they touch and rock a little, not quite closing. And then you could open your eyes for a minute if you wanted to, remembered to, and watch the shadow of the rocking leaves on the breast beside you."
"For sweet Jesus, Schopenhauer," McCord said. "What the bloody hell kind of ninth-rate Teasdale is this? You haven't near done your share of starving yet. You haven't near served your apprenticeship to destitution. If you're not careful, you'll talk that stuff to some guy who will believe it, and'll hand you the pistol and see you use it. Stop thinking about yourself and think about Charlotte for a while."
"That's who I'm talking about. But I wouldn't use the pistol anyway, because I started this too late. I still believe in love."
Then he told McCord about the cashier's check. "If I didn't believe in it, I'd give you the check and send her back with you tonight.
And if you believed in it as much as you say you do, you would have torn that check up a long time ago."
"If I tore it up, nobody would ever get the money. He couldn't even get it back from the bank."
"Damn him! You don't owe him anything. Didn't you take his wife off his hands for him?"
"Yeah, you're a hell of a guy. You haven't even got the courage of your fornications, have you?"
McCord rose.
"Come on, I smell coffee."
Wilburn didn't move, his hand still in the water.
"I haven't hurt her."
Then he said,
"Yes, I have. If I hadn't marked her by now, I would—"
"What?"
"Refuse to believe it."
For a full minute, McCord stood looking down at the other as he squatted, the bottle in one hand and the other wrist deep in the water.
"Shit," he said. Then Charlotte called them from the door.
Wilburn rose.
"I wouldn't use the pistol," he said. "I'll still take this."
Charlotte did not take the drink. Instead, she set the bottle on the mantel.
"To remind us of our lost civilization when our hair begins to spread," she said.
They ate. There were two iron cots in each of the two bedrooms, two more on the screened porch. While Wilburn washed the dishes, Charlotte and McCord made up the cots on the porch with bedding from the locker. When Wilburn came out, McCord already lay on one cot, his shoes off, smoking.
"Go on," he said. "Take it. Charlotte says she don't want to sleep anymore."
She came out at that moment, carrying a pad of paper, a tin cup, a new japanned color box.
"We had $1.50 left over, even after we bought the whiskey," she said. Maybe that deer will come back.
Take some salt to put on his tail, McCord said. Maybe he will stand still and pose for you.
I don't want him to pose. That's just what I don't want. I don't want to copy a deer. Anybody can do that.
She went on. The screen door slapped behind her. Wilburn did not look after her. He lay smoking, too, his hands beneath his head.
Listen, McCord said. You've got a lot of food. There's plenty of wood here, and cover when it turns cold. And when things begin to open up in town, maybe I can sell some of that junk she made. Get orders.
I'm not worrying. I told you I am happy.
Nothing can take what I have already had away from me.
Now ain't that just sweet? Listen, why don't you give me that damn check and send her back with me? And you can eat through your $100 and then move into the woods and eat ants and play St. Anthony in a tree. And on Christmas you can take a mussel shell and make yourself a present of your own oysters. I'm going to sleep.
He turned over and seemed to go to sleep at once. And soon Wilburn slept too. He waked once and knew by the sun that it was past noon and that she was not in the house. But he was not concerned. Lying awake for a moment, it was not the 27 barren years he looked at, and she would not be far, the path straight and empty and quiet between the two $50 rows of cans and sacks. She would wait for him.
If that is to be, she will wait, he thought. If we are to lie so, it will be together in the wavering solitude, in spite of Mac and his ninth-rate Teasdale, who seems to remember a hell of a lot of what people read. Beneath the red and yellow drift of the waning year, the myriad kissing of the repeated leaves.
The sun was just above the trees when she returned. The top sheet of the pad was still blank, though the paints had been used.
"Were they that bad?" McCord said.
He was busy at the stove with beans and rice and dried apricots, one of those secret cooking or eating specialties such as every bachelor seems to have, and which some can actually produce, though you would have said at first glance, not McCord.
Maybe a little bird told her what you were doing with 50 cents worth of our grub, so she had to run, Wilburn said.
The concoction was ready at last. It was not so bad, Wilburn admitted.
Only I don't know whether it actually is not foul, or if it's something protective. That what I taste is not this at all, but the 40 or 50 cents it represents. If maybe I don't have a gland for cowardice in my palate, or stomach, too.
He and Charlotte washed the dishes. McCord went out and returned with an armful of wood and laid a fire.
We won't need that tonight, Wilburn said.
It won't cost you anything but the wood, McCord said. And you've got from here to the Canadian line to get more from. You can run all northern Wisconsin up this chimney if you want to.
Then they sat before the fire, smoking and not talking a great deal, until time for McCord to leave. He would not stay, holiday tomorrow or not. Wilburn went out to the car with him, and he got into it, looking back at Charlotte in silhouette against the fire in the door.
"Yeah," he said. "You don't need to worry. No more than an old lady being led across the street by a policeman or an Eagle Scout. Because when the damned, bloody, wild, drunken car comes along, it won't be the old lady. It will be the cop or the scout it busts the hell out of.
Watch yourself."
"Watch myself?"
"Yeah. You can't be even afraid all the time without taking some pains."
Wilburn returned to the house. It was late, yet she had not begun to undress. Again he mused, not on the adaptability of women to circumstance, but on the ability of women to adapt the illicit, even the criminal, to a bourgeois standard of respectability, as he watched her, barefoot, moving about the room, making those subtle alterations in the fixtures of this temporary abode, as they even do in hotel rooms rented for but one night. Producing from one of the boxes which he had believed to contain only food objects from their apartment in Chicago, which he not only did not know she still had,
but had forgotten they ever owned, the books they had acquired, a copper bowl, even the chintz cover from the ex-workbench, then from a cigarette carton which she had converted into a small receptacle resembling a coffin, the tiny figure of the old man, the bad smell. He watched her set it on the mantel and stand looking at it for a time, musing too, then take up the bottle with the drink they had saved her, and, with the ritualistic sobriety of a child playing, pour the whiskey onto the hearth. "The Lares and Penates," she said. "I don't know Latin, but they will know what I mean." They slept in the two cots on the porch, then, it turning cold just before dawn, in one cot, her bare feet fast on the boards, the hard plunge of elbow and hip waking him as she came into the blankets, smelling of bacon and balsam. There was a gray light on the lake, and when he heard the loon, he knew exactly what it was. He even knew what it would look like, listening to the raucous idiot voice, thinking how man alone of all creatures deliberately atrophies his natural senses, and that only at the expense of others. How the four-legged animal gains all its information through smelling and seeing and hearing, and distrusts all else, while the two-legged one believes only what it reads. The fire felt good the next morning. While she washed the breakfast dishes, he cut more wood for it behind the cabin, removing his sweater now, the sun definitely impacting now, though he was not fooled. Thinking how in these latitudes Labor Day and not Equinox marked the suspiration of summer, the long sigh toward autumn and the cold, when she called him from the house. He entered. In the middle of the room stood a stranger carrying, balanced on his shoulder, a large cardboard box. A man no older than himself, barefoot, in faded khaki slacks and a sleeveless singlet, sun-browned, with blue eyes and pale, sunburned lashes and symmetrical ridges of straw-colored hair, the perfect reflexive coiffer, who was looking quietly at the effigy on the mantel. Through the open door behind him, Wilburn saw a beached canoe.
"This is," Charlotte said. "What did you say your name was?"
"Bradley," the stranger said. He looked at Wilburn, his eyes almost white against his skin, like a Kodak negative, balancing the box on his shoulder while he extended the other hand.
"Wilburn," Charlotte said, "Bradley's the neighbor. He's leaving today. He brought us what grub they had left."
"No use lugging it out again," Bradley said. "Your wife tells me you folks are going to stay on a while, so I thought." He gave Wilburn a brief, hard, violent, bone-crushing, meaningless grip. The broker's front man 2 years out of an eastern college.
"That's decent of you. We'll be glad to have it. Here, let me."
But the other had already swung the box to the floor. It was well filled. Charlotte and Wilburn carefully did not look at it.
"Thanks a lot. The more we have in the house, the harder it will be for the wolf to get in."
"Or to crowd us out when he does," Charlotte said.
Bradley looked at her. He laughed, that is, with his teeth. His eyes did not laugh, the assured, predatory eyes of the still successful prom leader.
"Not bad," he said. "Do you—" "Thanks," Charlotte said. "Will you have some coffee?"
"Thanks, I've had breakfast. We were up at dawn. Must be back in town tonight." Now he looked at the effigy on the mantel again. "May I?" he said. He approached the mantel.
"Do I know him? I seem—"
"I hope not," Charlotte said. Bradley looked at her.
"We hope not yet, she means," Wilburn said.
But Bradley continued to watch Charlotte, the pale brows courteously interrogatory above the predatory eyes, which did not smile when the mouth did.
"It's the bad smell," Charlotte said.
"Oh, I see." He looked at the effigy. "You made it. I saw you sketching yesterday, across the lake."
"I know you did."
"Touch," he said. "Can I apologize? I wasn't spying." I wasn't hiding. Bradley looked at her, and now Wilburn, for the first time, saw the eyes, brows, and mouth in accord, quizzical, sardonic, ruthless, the whole man emanating a sort of crass and insolent confidence.
Sure, he said.
Sufficiently, Charlotte said.
She moved to the mantel and took the effigy from it.
It's too bad you are leaving before we can return your call upon your wife, but perhaps you will accept this as a memento of your perspicuity.
No, really, I—
Take it, Charlotte said pleasantly. You must need it much worse than we do.
Well, thanks. He took the effigy. Thanks. We've got to get back to town tonight, but maybe we could look in on the way out. Mrs. Bradley would—
Do,
Charlotte said.
Thanks, he said.
He turned toward the door.
Thanks again.
Thanks again, too, Charlotte said.
He went out. Wilburn watched him shove the canoe off and step into it. Then Wilburn went and stooped over the box.
What are you going to do?
Charlotte said.
I'm going to carry it back and throw it in his front door.
Oh, you bloody ass, she said.
She came to him.
Stand up. We're going to eat it. Stand up like a man.
He rose. She put her hard arms around him, wrestling him against her with restrained, savage impatience.
Why don't you grow up, you damned home-wrecking Boy Scout?
Don't you know yet that we just don't look married, thank God, even to brutes?
She held him hard against her, leaning back, her hips against him and moving faintly while she stared at him, the yellow stare inscrutable and derisive, and with that quality which he had come to recognize, that ruthless and almost unbearable honesty.
Like a man, I said, holding him hard and derisive against her moving hips, as though that was not necessary.
She don't need to touch me, he thought, nor the sound of her voice, even, nor the smell. A slipper will do it. One of those fragile instigations to venery discarded in the floor.
Come on. That's right. That's better. That's fine now.
She freed one hand and began to unfasten his shirt.
Only this is supposed to be bad luck or something in the forenoon, isn't it? Or isn't it?
Yes, he said. Yes. She began to unfasten his belt.
Or is this just the way you assuage insults to me? Or are you going to bed with me just because somebody happened to remind you I divide at the belly?
Yes, he said. Yes. Later in the forenoon, they heard Bradley's car depart. Face down and half lying across him, she had been asleep, her weight heavy and relaxed, her head beneath his chin, her breath slow and full. She raised up, one elbow in his stomach, and the blanket slipping away from her shoulders, while the sound of the car died away.
"Well, Adam," she said,
but they had always been alone, he told her. "Ever since that first night, that picture, we couldn't be any more alone, no matter who went away."
"I know it. I mean, I can go swimming now."
She slid out from beneath the blanket. He watched her, the grave, simple body a little broader, a little solider than the Hollywood magazine cod liver oil advertisements, the bare feet padding across the rough boards toward the screen door. "There are bathing suits in the locker," he said. She didn't answer. The screen door slapped. Then he could not see her any more, or he would have had to raise his head. She swam each morning, the three bathing suits still undisturbed in the locker. He would rise from breakfast and return to the porch and lie on the cot and hear presently her bare feet cross the room and then the porch. Perhaps he would watch the steadily and smoothly browning body cross the porch. Then he would sleep again, this scarcely an hour after he had waked from slumber, a habit which he formed within the first 6 days. To wake later and look out and see her lying on the pier on stomach or back, her arms folded across or beneath her face. Sometimes he would still be there, not sleeping now and not even thinking, but merely existing in a drowsy and fetus-like state, passive and almost unsentient in the womb of solitude and peace. When she returned, moving then only enough to touch his lips to the sun-impacted flank as she stopped beside the cot, tasting the impacted sun. Then one day, something happened to him. September had gone. The nights and mornings were definitely chilly. She had changed her swim from after breakfast to after lunch, and they were talking about when they would have to move the bedding in from the porch to the room with the fireplace. But the days themselves were unchanged, the same stationary recapitulation of golden interval between dawn and sunset, the long, quiet, identical days, the immaculate, monotonous hierarchy of noons filled with the sun's hot honey, through which the waning year drifted in red and yellow retrograde of hardwood leaves, sourceless and going nowhere. Each day she departed directly after her swim and sunbath with the pad and color box, leaving him to move about the house empty, yet at the same time thunderous with the hard impact of her presence. The few garments she owned, the whisper of her bare feet on the boards, while he believed that he was worrying not about the inevitable day on which their food would run out, but at the fact that he did not seem to worry about it. A curious state which he had experienced once before, when his sister's husband had taken him to task one summer because he refused to exercise his vote. He remembered the exasperation, just about to become rage, in which he had tried to present his reasons to his brother-in-law, realizing at last that he was talking faster and faster not to convince the brother-in-law, but to justify his own rage, as in a mild nightmare he might be grasping for his falling trousers, that it was not even to his brother-in-law he was talking, but to himself. It became an obsession with him. He realized quite calmly that he had become secretly, quietly, and decently a little mad. He now thought constantly of the diminishing row of cans and sacks against which he was matching in inverse ratio the accumulating days. Yet he would not go to the closet and look at them, count them. He would tell himself how it used to be he would have to steal away to a park bench and take out the wallet and produce the scrap of paper and subtract numbers from one another, while now all he would have to do would be to glance at the row of cans on a shelf. He could count the cans and know exactly how many days more they would have left. He could take a pencil and mark the shelf itself off into days, and he would not even have to count cans. He could glance at the shelf and read the position at once, like on a thermometer. But he would not even look into the closet. He knew that during these hours he was mad, and he fought against it sometimes, believing that he had conquered the madness, for in the next succeeding instant the cans, save for a tragic conviction that they did not even matter, were as completely out of his mind as if they had never existed, and he would look about at his familiar surroundings with a sense of profound despair, not even knowing that he was worrying now, worrying so terribly that he did not even know it. He looked about with a kind of aghast amazement at the sun-filled solitude out of which she had walked temporarily, yet still remained in, and to which she would presently return and re-enter her aura, which had remained behind exactly as she might re-enter a garment, and find him stretched on the cot, not sleeping now and not even reading, who had lost that habit along with the habit of sleep, and said quietly to himself, "I am bored. I am bored to extinction. There is nothing here that I am needed for, not even by her. I have already cut enough wood to last until Christmas, and there is nothing else for me to do." One day he asked her to divide the colors and pad with him. She did so, and found that he was colorblind and didn't even know it. Then each day he would lie on his back in a small sunny clearing he had found, surrounded by the fierce, astringent smell of balsam, smoking the cheap pipe, the one provision he had made before leaving Chicago against the day they would exhaust food and money both. His half of the sketchpad and his converted sardine can color box intact and pristine beside him. Then one day he decided to make a calendar, a notion innocently conceived not by mind out of a desire for a calendar, but from the sheer boredom of muscles, and put into effect with the pure, quiet, sensory pleasure of a man carving a basket from a peach stone or the Lord's Prayer on a pinhead. He drew it neatly off on the sketchpad, numbering in the days, planning to use various appropriate colors for Sundays and the holidays. He discovered at once that he had lost count of the days, but this only added to the anticipation, prolonging the work, making more involved the pleasure, the peach basket to be a double one, the prayer to be in code. So he went back to that first morning when he and McCord squatted beside the water, whose name and number he knew. Then he counted forward by reconstructing from memory the drowsing demarcations between one dawn and the next, unraveling one by one out of the wine-sharp and honey-still warp of tideless solitude the lost Tuesdays and Fridays and Sundays, when it suddenly occurred to him that he could prove his figures, establish mathematical truth out of the sunny and timeless void into which the individual days had vanished, by the dates of and intervals between Charlotte's menstrual periods. He felt as some old crook-propped contemplator on the ancient, sheep-drifted Syrian hills must have felt after stumbling by accident on some Alexandrian formula which proved the starry truths which he had watched nightly all his life and knew to be true, but not how nor why. That was when the thing happened to him. He sat looking at what he had made in a gleeful and amazed amusement at his own cunning and in contriving for God, for nature the unmathematical, the over-fecund, the prime disorderly and illogical and patternless spendthrift, to prove his mathematical problem for him. When he discovered that he had given 6 weeks to the month of October, and that the day in which he now stood was November 12th. It seemed to him that he could see the actual numeral, incontrovertible and solitary, in the anonymous, identical hierarchy of the lost days. He seemed to see the row of cans on the shelf a half mile away, the dynamic, torpedo-like solid shapes which up to now had merely dropped, one by one, silently and without weight, into that stagnant time which did not advance, and which would somehow find for its two victims food as it found them breath, now in reverse to time. Time now the mover, advancing slow and irresistible, blotting the cans one by one in steady progression, as a moving cloud shadow blots. Yes, he thought, it's the Indian summer that did it. I've been seduced to an imbecile's paradise by an old whore. I have been throttled and sapped of strength and volition by the old weary Lilith of the year. He burned the calendar and went back to the cabin. She had not returned yet. He went to the closet and counted the cans. It was 2 hours to sunset yet. When he looked out toward the lake, he saw that there was no sun, and that a mass of cloud, like dirty cotton, had crossed from east to north and west, and that the feel and taste of the air, too, had changed. Yes, he thought, the old bitch. She betrayed me, and now she doesn't need to pretend. At last he saw her approaching, circling the lake in a pair of his trousers and an old sweater they had found in the locker with the blankets. He went to meet her. "Good Lord," she said, "I never saw you look so happy. Have you painted a picture, or have you discovered at last that the human race really doesn't have to even try to produce art?" He was moving faster than he knew. When he put his arms around her, he jolted her to a stop by physical contact. Thrust back,
she looked at him with actual and not simulated astonishment now.
"Yes," he said. "How's for a spot of necking?"
"Why, certainly, friend," she said immediately. Then she thrust herself back again to look at him. "What's this? What's going on here?"
"Will you be afraid to stay here alone tonight?"
Now she began to free herself.
"Let me go. I can't see you good."
He released her, though he did manage to meet the unwinking yellow stare which he had never yet been able to lie to.
"Tonight?"
"This is the 12th of November."
"All right. Then what?"
She looked at him.
"Come on. Let's go to the house and get to the bottom of this."
They returned to the house. Again she paused and faced him.
"Now let's have it."
"I just counted the cans, measured the—" She stared at him with that hard, almost grim impersonality.
"We can eat for about 6 days more."
"All right. Then what?"
"It was the mild weather. Like time had stopped, and us with it, like two chips on a pond. So I didn't think to worry, to watch. So I'm going to walk to the village. It's only 12 miles. I could be back by noon tomorrow."
She stared at him.
"A letter. From Mac. It will be there."
"Did you dream it would be there, or did you find it out in the coffee pot when you were measuring the grub?"
"It will be there."
"All right. But wait till tomorrow to go. You can't walk 12 miles before dark." They ate and went to bed. This time she came straight and got into the cot with him, as heedless of the hard and painful elbow which jabbed him as she would have been on her own account if the positions had been reversed, as she was of the painful hand which grasped his hair and shook his head with savage impatience.
"My God, I never in my life saw anybody try as hard to be a husband as you do. Listen to me, you lug. If it was just a successful husband and food and a bed I wanted, why the hell do you think I am here instead of back there where I had them?"
"You've got to sleep and eat."
"Certainly we have. So why worry about it? That's like worrying about having to bathe just because the water in the bathroom is about to be cut off."
Then she rose, got out of the cot with the same abrupt violence. He watched her cross to the door and open it and look out. He could smell the snow before she spoke.
"It's snowing."
"I know it. I knew this afternoon she realized the game was up."
"She?"
She closed the door. This time she went to the other cot and got into it.
"Try to get to sleep. It'll be a hard walk tomorrow, if it snows much."
"It will be there, though."
"Yes," she said.
She yawned, her back to him.
"It's probably been there a week or two."
He left the cabin shortly after daylight. The snow had ceased, and it was quite cold. He reached the village in 4 hours and found the letter from McCord. It contained a check for $25. He had sold one of the puppets, and he had the promise of a job for Charlotte in a department store during the holiday season. It was well after dark when he reached home.
"You can put it all in the pot," he said. "We've got $25, and Mac's got a job for you. He's driving up Saturday night."
"Saturday night?"
"I wired him. I waited for an answer. That's why I'm late."
They ate, and this time she got quietly into the narrow cot with him, and this time she even crept close to him, who had never before known her to do such at any time, to anything.
"I'll be sorry to leave here."
"Will you?"
he said quietly, peacefully, lying on his back, his arms crossed on his chest like a stone effigy on a 10th-century sepulchre.
"You'll probably be glad to get back, once you are there, though. People to see again. McCord and the others you liked. Christmas and all that. You can get your hair clean again, and your nails manicured."
This time she did not move, whose habit it was to assault him with that cold and disregardful savageness, shaking and jerking at him not only for conversion, but even for mere emphasis. This time she lay perfectly still, not even breathing.
her voice filled not with a suspiration, but sheer, amazed incredulity.
You'll probably. You are. You can.
Harry, what do you mean?
That I wired Mac to come and get you. You'll have your job. That will keep you until after Christmas, all right. I thought I'd just keep half the $25 and stay on here. Maybe Mac can find something for me, too. If nothing else, maybe a WPA job of some sort. Then I'd come on back to town, and then we could—
No! She cried. No, no! Jesus God, no! Hold me. Hold me hard, Harry. This is what it's for. What it all was for. What we were paying for. So we could be together. Sleep together every night. Not just to eat and evacuate and sleep warm so we can get up and eat and evacuate in order to sleep warm again. Hold me. Hold me hard. Hard.
He held her, his arms rigid, his face still turned upward, his lips lifted away from his rigid teeth.
God, he thought. God help her. God help her.
They left snow at the lake, though before they reached Chicago they had overtaken the end of the south-moving Indian summer for a little while. But it did not last, and now it was winter in Chicago, too. The Canadian wind made ice in the lake and blew in the stone canyons, holly-burgeoned with the imminent Christmas, crisping and frosting the faces of policemen and clerks and panhandlers and Red Cross and Salvation Army people costumed as Santa Claus, the defunctive days dying in neon upon the fur-framed petal faces of the wives and daughters of cattle and timber millionaires, and the paramours of politicians returned from Europe and the dude ranches to spend the holidays in the air-carved and opulent tenements above the Iron Lake and the rich, sprawling city before departing for Florida, and of the sons of London brokers and Midland shoe-peg knights and South African senators come to look at Chicago because they had read Whitman and Masters and Sandburg in Oxford or Cambridge, members of that race which, without tact for exploration and armed with notebooks and cameras and sponge bags, elects to pass the season of Christian holiday in the dark and bitten jungles of savages. Charlotte's job was in a store which had been one of her first customers for the first figurines she had made. It included window and showcase dressing, so that her day sometimes began when the store closed in the afternoon, and that of the other employees ceased. So Wilburn and sometimes McCord would wait for her in a bar just around the corner, where they would eat an early dinner. Then McCord would depart to begin his upside-down day at the newspaper, and Charlotte and Wilburn would return to the store, which would now take on a sort of bizarre and infernal inverted life. The chromium, glass, and synthetic marble cavern, which for 8 hours had been filled with the ruthless, voracious murmur of furred shoppers and the fixed, regimented grimaces of satin-clad, robot-like saleswomen, now empty of uproar, glittering and quiet and echoed with cavernous silence, dwarfing, filled now with a grim, tense fury like an empty midnight clinic, in which a handful of pygmy-like surgeons and nurses battle in low-toned decorum for some obscure and anonymous life, into which Charlotte would vanish too, not disappear. He would see her from time to time, consulting in pantomime with someone over some object which one of them held, or entering or leaving a window, as soon as they entered. He would have an evening paper, and now, for the next 2 or 3 hours, he would sit on fragile chairs surrounded by jointless figures with suave, organless bodies and serene, almost incredible faces, by draped brocade and sequins or the glitter of rhinestones, while charwomen appeared on their knees and pushing pails before them as though they were another species just crawled mole-like from some tunnel or orifice
leading from the foundations of the earth itself, and serving some obscure principle of sanitation, not to the hushed glitter which they did not even look at, but to the subterranean region which they would crawl back to before light. Then, at 11 and midnight, and as Christmas approached even later, they would go home, to the apartment which had no workbench and no skylight now, but which was new and neat, and in a new, neat district near a park, toward which, around 10 o'clock in the morning, while lying in bed between his first and second sleep of the day, he could hear the voices of nursemaid-harried children moving, where Charlotte would go to bed, and he would sit again at the typewriter at which he had already spent most of the day, the machine borrowed first from McCord, then rented from an agency, then purchased outright from among the firing pinless pistols and guitars and gold-filled teeth in a pawn shop, on which he wrote and sold to the confession magazines the stories beginning, "I had the body and desires of a woman, yet in knowledge and experience of the world I was but a child," or, "If I had only had a mother's love to guard me on that fatal day." Stories which he wrote complete from the first capital to the last period in one sustained, frenzied, agonizing rush, like the halfback working his way through school who grasps the ball, his albatross, his old man of the sea, which, not the opposing team, not the blank, incontrovertible chalk marks profoundly terrifying and meaningless as an idiot's nightmare, is his sworn and mortal enemy, and runs until the play is completed, downed or across the goal line, it doesn't matter which. Then to go to bed himself, with dawn sometimes beyond the open window of the chill sleeping cubicle, to get into bed beside Charlotte, who, without waking, would sometimes turn to him, murmuring something damp and indistinguishable out of sleep, and to lie again, holding her, as on that last night at the lake, himself wide awake, carefully rigid and still, knowing no desire to sleep, waiting for the smell and echo of his last batch of moron's pap to breathe out of him. Thus he was awake mostly while she slept, and vice versa. She would get up and close the window and dress and make coffee, the breakfast which, while they were poor, when they did not know for certain where the next measure of coffee to put into the pot was coming from, they would prepare and eat together, the dishes of which they would wash and dry together, side by side, at the sink, and be gone, and he would not know it. Then he, in his turn, would wake and listen to the passing children while the stale coffee heated, and drink it, and sit down to the typewriter, entering, without effort and without especial regret, the anesthesia of his monotonous inventing. At first he made a kind of ritual of his solitary lunch, fetching in the cans and slices of meat and such the night before, like a little boy with a new Daniel Boone suit hoarding crackers in the improvised forest of a broom closet. But lately, since he had actually bought the typewriter, he had voluntarily relinquished his amateur standing, he told himself then. He no longer had even to pretend to himself it was a lark. He began to dispense with lunch altogether, with the bother of eating, instead writing steadily on, pausing only to sit while his fingers rested, a cigarette scarring slowly into the edge of the rented table, staring at but not seeing the two or three current visible lines of his latest primer, bald, moronic fable, his sexual gumdrop, then remembering the cigarette and raising it to rub uselessly at the new scorch before writing again. Then the hour would arrive, and with the ink sometimes scarcely dry on the stamped, sealed, and self-addressed envelope containing the latest story, beginning, "At 16 I was an unwed mother," he would leave the apartment and walk through the crowded streets, the steadily shortening afternoons of the dying year,
to the bar where he and Charlotte and McCord met. There was Christmas in the bar, too, holly sprigs and mistletoe among the gleaming pyramids of glasses, mirror repeated, the mirror aping the antic jackets of the barmen, the steaming seasonal bowls of hot rum and whiskey for the patrons to look at and recommend to one another while holding in their hands the same iced cocktails and highballs they had been drinking all summer. Then McCord at their usual table, with what he called breakfast, a quart stein of beer and about another quart of pretzels or salted peanuts or whatever was available, and Wilburn would have the one drink which he allowed himself before Charlotte came.
"I can afford abstemiousness now, sobriety," he told McCord. "I can pay shot for shot and no holds barred with any and all for the privilege of refusing." And they would wait for the hour when the stores would empty, the glass doors flashing outward to erupt into the tender, icy glare of neon, the holly-pinned, fur-framed faces, the wind-carved canyons, merry and crisp with the bright voices speaking the good wishes and goodwill into intransigent vapor, the employees' chute, too, discharging presently the regimented black satin, the feet swollen with the long standing, the faces aching with the sustained, long, rigid grimacing. Then Charlotte would enter. They would stop talking and watch her approach, shifting and sidling past the throng at the bar and among the waiters and the crowded tables, her coat open above the neat uniform, her hat of the current off-the-face mode thrust further back still, as if she had pushed it there herself with a sweep of the forearm in the immemorial female gesture out of the immemorial female weariness. Approaching the table, her face pale and tired-looking too, though she moved as strongly and surely as ever, the eyes as humorlessly and incorrigibly honest as ever above the blunt, strong nose, the broad, pale, unsubtle mouth. "Rum, men," she would say then, sinking into the chair which one of them drew for her. "Well, Papa." Then they would eat, at the wrong hour, the hour when the rest of the world was just beginning to prime itself for food. "I feel like three bears in a cage on Sunday afternoon," she said, eating the meal which none of them wanted, and then disperse, McCord to the paper, Charlotte and Wilburn back to the store. 2 days before Christmas, when she entered the bar, she carried a parcel. It contained Christmas gifts for her children, the two girls. They had no workbench now, and no skylight. She unwrapped and rewrapped them on the bed, the immemorial, the workbench of the child's unwitting begetting, become the altar for the child's service. She, sitting on the edge of it, surrounded by holly-stippled paper and the fatuous, fragile, red and green cord and gummed labels, the two gifts she had chosen reasonably costly but unremarkable. She, looking at them with a sort of grim bemusement above the hands, otherwise and at nearly every other human action, unhesitating and swift. "They haven't even taught me how to wrap up packages," she said. "Children," she said. "It's not a child's function, really. It's for adults. A week's dispensation to return to childishness, to give something you don't want yourself to someone who doesn't want it either, and demand thanks for it. And the children swap with you. They vacate puerility and accept the role you abandoned, not because they ever had any particular desire to be grown, but just out of that ruthless piracy of children that will use anything, deception or secrecy or acting, to get anything. Anything. Any bauble will do. Presents don't mean anything to them unless they get big enough to calculate what it probably cost. That's why little girls are more interested in presents than little boys. So they take what you give them, not because they will accept even that in preference to nothing,
but because that's about all they expected anyway from the stupid oxen among whom, for some reason, they have to live. They have offered to keep me on at the store.
What?
He said. He had not been listening to her. He had been hearing, but not listening, looking down at the blunt hands among the tinsel litter, thinking, now is the time for me to say, go home. Be with them tomorrow night.
What?
They are going to keep me on until summer at the store. He heard this time. He went through the same experience as when he had recognized the number on the calendar he had made. Now he knew what the trouble had been all the time, why he would lie rigidly and carefully beside her in the dawn, believing the reason he could not sleep was that he was waiting for the smell of his moron pandering to fade, why he would sit before an unfinished page in the typewriter, believing he was thinking of nothing, believing he was thinking only of the money, how each time they always had the wrong amount of it, and that they were about money like some unlucky people were about alcohol, either none or too much. It was the city I was thinking of, he thought. The city and winter together, a combination too strong for us, yet, for a time, yet, the winter that herds people inside walls wherever they are, but winter and city together, a dungeon, the routine even of sinning, an absolution even for adultery. No, he said, because we are going to leave Chicago.
Leave Chicago?
Yes, for good. You're not going to work any more just for money. Wait, he said quickly. I know we have come to live like we had been married 5 years, but I am not coming the heavy husband on you. I know I catch myself thinking I want my wife to have the best, but I'm not yet saying I don't approve of my women working. It's not that. It's what we have come to work for, got into the habit of working for before we knew it, almost waited too late before we found it out. Do you remember how you said up at the lake when I suggested that you clear out while the clearing was good, and you said, that's what we bought, what we are paying for, to be together and eat together and sleep together? And now look at us. When we are together, it's in a saloon or a streetcar or walking along a crowded street. And when we eat together, it's in a crowded restaurant, inside a vacant hour they allow you from the store so you can eat and stay strong, so they can get the value of the money they pay you every Saturday. And we don't sleep together at all anymore. We take turns watching each other sleep. When I touch you, I know you are too tired to wake up, and you are probably too tired to touch me at all. 3 weeks later, with a scribbled address on a torn newspaper margin folded in his vest pocket, he entered a downtown office building and ascended 20 floors to an opaque glass door lettered Callahan Mines, and entered and passed with some difficulty a chromium-finished office girl, and faced at last across a desk flat and perfectly bare, save for a telephone and a deck of cards laid out for Canfield, a red-faced, cold-eyed man of about 50, with a highwayman's head and the body of a 220-pound college fullback gone to fat, in a suit of expensive tweed which nevertheless looked on him as if he had taken it from a fire sale at the point of a pistol, to whom Wilburn essayed to give a summary of his medical qualifications and experience. "Never mind that," the other interrupted. "Can you take care of the ordinary injuries that men working in a mine shaft might meet?"
"I was just trying to tell you."
"I heard you. I asked you something else. I said, take care of them." Wilburn looked at him.
"I don't think I," he began,
"take care of the mine, of the people who own it, have put money into it, who will be paying your salary as long as you earn it. I don't care two damns in hell how much or how little surgery and pharmacology you know or don't know, or how many degrees you might have from where to show it. Nobody else out there will.
There'll be no state inspectors out there to ask to see your license. I want to know if you can be depended on to protect the mine, the company, against backfires. Suits from wop pick-and-shovel men and bohunk powder monkeys and chink ore trammers, to whom the notion might occur to swap the company a hand or a foot for a pension or a trip back to Canton or Hong Kong.
Oh, Wilburn said, I see. Yes, I can do that.
All right. You will be given transportation out to the mine at once. Your pay will be... He named a sum.
That's not much, Wilburn said.
The other looked at him with the cold, flesh-bedded eyes. Wilburn stared back at him.
I have a degree from a good university, a recognized medical school. I lacked only a few weeks of finishing my internship at a hospital, which has a...
Then you don't want this job. This job is nowhere near up to your qualifications, and, I dare say, your deserts. Good day.
The cold eyes stared at him. He did not move.
I said good morning.
I will have to have transportation for my wife, Wilburn said.
Their train left at 3 o'clock 2 mornings later. They waited for McCord at the apartment where they had lived for 2 months, and left no mark other than the cigarette scars on the table.
Not even of loving, he said. Not the wild sweet attunement, bare feet hurrying bedward in the half-light, covers that won't turn back fast enough. Just the seminal groaning of box springs, the preprandial prostate relieving of the 10 years married. We were too busy. We had to rent and support a room for 2 robots to live in. McCord came, and they carried down the luggage, the 2 bags with which they had left New Orleans, and the typewriter. The manager shook hands with all 3 of them and expressed regret at the dissolution of mutually pleasant domestic bonds.
"Just 2 of us," Wilburn said. "None of us are androgynous."
The manager blinked, though just once.
"Ah," he said, "a pleasant journey. You have a cab."
They had McCord's car. They went out to it in a mild glitter of miner silver, the final neon and clash and clang of changing lights. The red cap turned the 2 bags and the typewriter over to the porter at the Pullman vestibule.
"We've got time for a drink," McCord said.
"You and Harry have one," Charlotte said. "I'm going to bed."
She came and put her arms around McCord, her face raised.
"Good night, Mac."
Then McCord moved and kissed her. She stepped back, turning. They watched her enter the vestibule and vanish. Then Wilburn also knew that McCord knew he would never see her again.
"How about that drink?" McCord said.
They went to the station bar and found a table, and then they were sitting again as they had on so many of the afternoons while they waited for Charlotte. The same drinking faces, the same white jackets of waiters and barmen, the same racked, gleaming glasses— only the steaming bowls and the holly. Christmas, McCord had said, the apotheosis of the bourgeoisie, the season when, with shining fable, heaven and nature, in accord for once, edict and postulate us all husbands and fathers under our skins, when, before an altar in the shape of a gold-plated cattle trough, man may with impunity prostrate himself in an orgy of unbridled, sentimental obeisance to the fairy tale which conquered the Western world. When for 7 days the rich get richer and the poor get poorer in amnesty, the whitewashing of a stipulated week leaving the page blank and pristine again for the chronicling of the fresh and, for the moment, horse-like. There's the horse, McCord said, breathed revenge and hatred. Missing now, the waiter coming up as he had used to come, the same white sleeve, the anonymous, featureless waiter face you never actually see.
Beer, McCord said. What's yours?
Ginger ale, Wilburn said.
What?
I'm on the wagon.
Since when?
Since last night, I can't afford to drink any more.
McCord looked at him.
Hell, McCord said. Bring me a double rye, then.
The waiter departed.
McCord still stared at Wilburn.
It seems to agree with you, he said savagely.
Listen, he said, I know this is none of my business, but I wish I knew what it's all about. Here you were, making fair money, and Charlotte with a good job. You had a nice place to live in, and then all of a sudden you quit it. Make Charlotte throw up her job to start out in February to live in a mine shaft in Utah, without a railroad or a telephone or even a decent can, on a salary of... That was just it. That was why I had become...
He ceased. The waiter set the drinks on the table and went away.
Wilburn raised his ginger ale.
To freedom.
I would, McCord snarled. You'll probably be able to drink to a lot of it before you see any of it again. And in water, too, not even in soda pop. And maybe in a tighter place than this, too. Because that guy is poison. I know about him. He's Wildcat. If the truth was written about him on a tombstone, it wouldn't be an epitaph. It would be a police record.
All right, Wilburn said. To love, then. There was a clock above the entrance, the ubiquitous and synchronized face, oracular, admonitory, and unsentient. He had 22 minutes yet.
While it will take only 2 minutes to tell Mac what it took me 2 months to discover, he thought.
I had turned into a husband, he said. That was all. I didn't even know it until she told me the store had offered to keep her on. At first I used to have to watch myself, rehearse myself each time so I would be sure to say, my wife or Mrs. Wilburn. Then I discovered I had been watching myself for months to keep from saying it. I have even caught myself twice since we came back from the lake, thinking, I want my wife to have the best.
Exactly like any husband, with his Saturday pay envelope and his suburban bungalow full of electric wife-saving gadgets, and his tablecloth of lawn to sprinkle on Sunday morning, that will become his actual own, provided he is not fired or run down by a car in the next 10 years. The doomed worm, blind to all passion and dead to all hope, and not even knowing it. Oblivious and unaware in the face of all darkness, all unknown, the underlying, all-derisive, biding to blast him. I'd even stopped being ashamed of the way I earned the money, apologizing even to myself for the stories I wrote. I was no more ashamed of them than the city employee buying his own bungalow on the installment plan, in which his wife can have the best, is ashamed of his badge of office, the rubber plunger for unstopping toilets, which he carries about with him. In fact, I had come to really like to write them, even apart from the money, like the boy who never saw ice before goes bugs about skating right after he learns how. Besides, after I started writing them, I learned that I had no idea of the depths of depravity of which the human invention is capable, which is always interesting.
You mean enjoys, McCord said.
Yes, all right.
Respectability. That was what did it.
I found out some time back that it's idleness breeds all our virtues, our most bearable qualities. Contemplation, equableness, laziness, letting other people alone, good digestion, mental and physical, the wisdom to concentrate on fleshly pleasures, eating and evacuating and fornication, and sitting in the sun, than which there is nothing better, nothing to match, nothing else in all this world but to live for the short time you are loaned breath, to be alive and know it. Oh, yes, she taught me that. She has marked me, too, forever. Nothing. Nothing. But it was only recently I have clearly seen, followed out the logical conclusion,
that it is one of what we call the prime virtues, thrift, industry, independence, that breeds all the vices, fanaticism, smugness, meddling, fear, and worst of all, respectability. Us, for instance, because of the fact that for the first time we were solvent, knew for certain where tomorrow's food was coming from. The damned money, too much of it. At night, we would lie awake and plan how to get it spent. By spring, we would have been carrying steamer folders in our pockets. I had become as completely thrall and slave to respectability as any. But not her, McCord said. No, but she's a better man than I am. You said that yourself, as any man by drink or opium. I had become the complete householder. All I lacked was official sanction in the form of a registered social security number as head of a family. We lived in an apartment that wasn't bohemian. It wasn't even a tabloid love nest. It wasn't even in that part of town, but in a neighborhood dedicated by both city ordinance and architecture to the second year of wedlock among the 5,000 a year bracket. I would be waked in the mornings by the noise of children passing in the street. By the time spring came and the windows would have to stay open, I would have been hearing the fretful cries of Swede nursemaids from the park all day long, and when the wind was right, smell the smell of infant urine and animal crackers. I referred to it as home. There was a corner in it we both called my study. I had even bought the damn typewriter at last, something I had got along without for 28 years, and so well I didn't even know it, which is too heavy and unwieldy to carry, yet which I would no more have dared desert than— You've still got it, I noticed, McCord said. Then, yes, a good portion of any courage is a sincere disbelief in good luck. It's not courage otherwise. Then I would my eyelashes. I had tied myself hand and foot in a little strip of inked ribbon. Daily I watched myself getting more and more tangled in it like a roach in a spider web. Each morning, so that my wife could leave on time for her job, I would wash the coffee pot and the sink, and twice a week, for the same reason, I would buy from the same butcher the groceries we needed and the chops we would cook ourselves on Sunday. Give us a little more time, and we would have been dressing and undressing inside our kimonos in one another's presence, and turning off the light before we made love. That's it. It's not avocation that elects our vocations. It's respectability that makes chiropractors and clerks and bill posters and motor men and pulp writers of us. There was a loudspeaker in the bar, too, synchronized, too. At this moment, a voice, cavernous and sourceless, roared deliberately, a sentence in which could be distinguished a word now and then. Train. Then others, which the mind 2 or 3 seconds afterward recognized to be the names of cities far-flung about the continent. Cities seen rather than names heard. As if the listener, so enormous was the voice, were suspended in space, watching the globy earth spin slowly out of its cradling cloud-wisps in fragmentary glimpses, the evocative, strange divisions of the sphere, spinning them on into fog and cloud again before vision and comprehension could quite grasp them. He looked at the clock again. He still had 14 minutes. 14 minutes to try to tell what I have already said in 5 words, he thought. And mind, I liked it. I never denied that. I liked it. I liked the money I made. I even liked the way I made it. The thing I did, as I told you. It wasn't because of that that one day I caught myself back from thinking, my wife must have the best. It was because I found out one day that I was afraid, and I found out at the same time that I will still be afraid, no matter what I do, that I will still be afraid as long as she lives or I live.
You are still afraid now.
Yes, and not about money. Damn money. I can make all the money we will need. Certainly, there seems to be no limit to what I can invent on the theme of female sex troubles. I don't mean that, nor Utah either. I mean us. Love, if you will. Because it can't last. There is no place for it in the world today, not even in Utah. We have eliminated it. It took us a long time, but man is resourceful and limitless in inventing, too. And so we have got rid of love at last, just as we have got rid of Christ. We have radio in the place of God's voice, and instead of having to save emotional currency for months and years to deserve one chance to spend it all for love, we can now spread it thin into coppers and titillate ourselves at any newsstand, two to the block, like sticks of chewing gum or chocolate from the automatic machines. If Jesus returned today, we would have to crucify him quick in our own defense, to justify and preserve the civilization we have worked and suffered and died shrieking and cursing in rage and impotence and terror for 2,000 years to create and perfect in man's own image. If Venus returned, she would be a soiled man in a subway lavatory with a palm full of French postcards. McCord turned in his chair and beckoned, a single, repressed, violent gesture. The waiter appeared. McCord pointed to his glass. Presently, the waiter's hand set the refilled glass on the table and withdrew.
All right, McCord said. So what?
I was in eclipse. It began that night in New Orleans when I told her I had $1,200, and it lasted until that night she told me the store would keep her on. I was outside of time. I was still attached to it, supported by it in space, as you have been ever since there was a not you to become you, and will be until there is an end to the not you by means of which alone you could once have been. That's the immortality. Supported by it, but that's all. Just on it. Non-conductive, like the sparrow insulated by its own hard, non-conductive, dead feet from the high tension line. The current of time that runs through remembering, that exists only in relation to what little of reality. I have learned that, too. We know. Else there is no such thing as time. You know, I was not, then I am, and time begins, retroactive, is, was, and will be. Then I was, and so I am not, and so time never existed. It was like the instant of virginity. It was the instant of virginity. That condition, fact that does not actually exist except during the instant you know you are losing it. It lasted as long as it did because I was too old. I waited too long. 27 is too long to wait to get out of your system what you should have rid yourself of at 14 or 15, or maybe even younger. The messy, wild, hurried fumbling of two panting amateurs beneath the front steps or in an afternoon hayloft. You remember, the precipice, the dark precipice. All mankind before you went over it and lived, and all after you will, but that means nothing to you, because they can't tell you, forewarn you what to do in order to survive. It's the solitude, you see. You must do it in solitude, and you can bear just so much solitude and still live, like electricity. And for this 1 or 2 seconds, you will be absolutely alone. Not before you were, and not after you are not, because you are never alone then. In either case, you are secure and companioned in a myriad and inextricable anonymity. In the one, dust from dust. In the other,
seething worms to seething worms. But now you are going to be alone. You must. You know it. It must be. So be it. You heard the beast you have ridden all your life, the old familiar, well-broken nag, up to the precipice. There's the damned horse, McCord said. I've been waiting for it. After 10 minutes, we sound like bit and spur. We don't talk. We moralize at each other, like two circuit-riding parsons traveling the same country lane. Maybe you thought all the time that when the moment came, you could rein back, save something. Maybe not. The instant comes, and you know you cannot. No, you knew all the time you could not, and you cannot. You are one single abnegant affirmation, one single fluxive yes out of the terror in which you surrender volition, hope, all. The darkness, the falling, the thunder of solitude, the shock, the death, the moment when stopped physically by the ponderable clay. You yet feel all your life rush out of you into the pervading, immemorial, blind, receptive matrix, the hot, fluid, blind foundation. Grave womb or womb grave, it's all one. But you return. Maybe you knew that all the time, but you return. Maybe you even live out your 70 or whatever it is, but forever afterward you will know that forevermore you have lost some of it, that for that 1 second or 2 seconds you were present in space but not in time, that you are not the 70 they have credited you with, and that you will have to discharge some day to make the books balance. But 69 and 300 and 64 and 23 and 58— Sweet Jesus, McCord said. Holy coriated cherubim. If I am ever unlucky enough to have a son, I'm going to take him to a nice clean whorehouse myself on his 10th birthday. So that's what happened to me, Wilburn said. I waited too long. What would have been 2 seconds at 14 or 15 was 8 months at 27. I was in eclipse, and we almost scraped bottom on that snowbound Wisconsin lake with $9.20 worth of food between us and starving. I beat that. I thought I did. I believed I waked up in time and beat that. We came back here, and I thought we were going great guns, until that night before Christmas when she told me about the store, and I realized what we had got into, that the starving was nothing. It could have done nothing but kill us, while this was worse than death, or division even. It was the mausoleum of love. It was the stinking catafalque of the dead corpse born between the olfactoryless walking shapes of the immortal, unsentient, demanding, ancient meat. The loudspeaker spoke again. They made to rise at the same time. At the same moment, the waiter materialized, and McCord paid him. "So I am afraid," Wilburn said. "I wasn't afraid then, because I was in eclipse. But I am awake now, and I can be afraid now, thank God. Because this Anno Domini 1938 has no place in it for love. They used money against me while I was asleep because I was vulnerable in money. Then I waked up and rectified the money, and I thought I had beat them, until that night when I found out they had used respectability on me, and that it was harder to beat than money. So I am vulnerable in neither money nor respectability now, and so they will have to find something else to force us to conform to the pattern of human life, which has now evolved to do without love, to conform or die." They entered the train shed, the cavernous gloom in which the constant electricity which knew no day from night burned wanly on toward the iron winter dawn among wisps of steam.
in which the long, motionless line of darkened Pullmans seemed to stand knee-deep, bedded and fixed forever in concrete. They passed the soot-dulled steel walls, the serried cubicles filled with snoring, to the open vestibule. So I am afraid, because they are smart, shrewd. They will have to be. If they were to let us beat them, it would be like unchecked murder and robbery. Of course, we can't beat them. We are doomed, of course. That's why I'm afraid. And not for me. Do you remember that night at the lake, when you said I was an old woman being led across the street by a policeman or a Boy Scout, and that when the drunken car came it would not be the old lady, it would... But why go to Utah in February to beat it? And if you can't beat it, why in hell go to Utah? Because I... Steam, air, hissed behind them in a long sigh. The porter appeared suddenly from nowhere, like the waiter had done. All right, gentlemen, he said. We're going. Wilburn and McCord shook hands. Maybe I'll write you, Wilburn said. Charlotte probably will, anyway. She's a better gentleman than I am, too. He stepped into the vestibule and turned, the porter behind him, his hand on the doorknob, waiting. He and McCord looked at one another, the two speeches unspoken between them, each knowing they would not be spoken. I won't see you again, and, no, you won't see us again. Because crows and sparrows get shot out of trees, or drowned by floods, or killed by hurricanes and fires, but not hawks. And maybe I can be the consort of a falcon, even if I am a sparrow. The train gathered itself. The first, the beginning of motion, departure, came back, car by car, and passed under his feet. And something I told myself up there at the lake, he said, that there is something in me she is not mistress to, but mother. Well, I have gone a step further. The train moved. He leaned out, McCord moving too, to keep pace with him. That there is something in me, you and she parented between you, that you are father of. Give me your blessing. Take my curse, McCord said.